Interview with Max Dresden, Professor of Physics, August 24th, 87, in my office in the library.
All right, fire away. Well, I came in the fall of 1964. I came as a full professor in the Department of Physics, and I had selected for the others offered a position a year before, but didn't take it. And then I came back and they take it.
Yeah, you came from?
I came from the University of Iowa, and it was in 1964, so I was born in 18, so I was about 46 years old, I mean, 1864, I was 46 years old. Okay, so I came from the University of Iowa. I primarily came to Stony Brook for actually two reasons. One reason was that I really had lived in the Midwest a long time, and I felt the time had come to move someplace else. So the Stony Brook offer came, and I took it. Actually, I had at that time four offers. I had an offer from Stony Brook, one from Case Institute of Technology, one from Notre Dame, and I had a possibility at Yale. And I might say I was very unsure about coming to Stony Brook at that time, but I thought if Stony Brook didn't work out, Yale surely would. So I was willing to buy a house, but I wasn't all sure. Also, the department at Iowa was collapsing, and I thought it was good to go, so that was the reason.
Was Jim Van Allen chairman?
Van Allen was chairman, and there was nothing wrong with Van Allen. In fact, Van Allen had a very fine enterprise, and he did very well. They also had a very strong theory group of about four or five, and for really a whole series of completely non-dramatic reasons. They all left. And so I was really the last civic in that department. And then I thought, well, really, maybe I should also be. One person got divorced, one person went back to Switzerland, one person went to Syracuse, another person wanted to be at a laboratory. So there was nothing dramatic. So it was in no way a reflection of my mother, who was most kind and very helpful. In fact, the interesting thing was, the reason I didn't come the first time this was offered to me, is that I would try to make it in Iowa. But what happened then is that the planes that used to stop in Chicago for transcontinental flights, they stopped. But no longer, they went right across. So nobody came anymore to Iowa City. The railroads no longer functioned. There was no way of coming there. And I had never mind getting people to come to the faculty members. I couldn't even get them to stop. And so that was actually instrumental. That was one of the reasons for deciding to really leave. I thought Stony Brook was new, it had great excitement, it seemed to have great promise, and then...
This was before John Toll came and before Frank.
This was before Frank then came and before John Toll came.
Yeah.
This was in 63 when I didn't come, and in 64 when I did come, I talked to Alec Pond.
Right.
And by the way, right after I talked to Alec Pond, let me remind you, I thought there was a possibility. And then you remind me there was a fellowship, a professorship for, there was a professorship which was given by the Foundation for Science and Technology. Was there, and in fact I talked to Alec Pond, who was the chairman, and I said, well, I should try to get a hand for that. And Alec Pond, I remember the thing, he said, he'll never come. I said, well, let me talk to him. It took a long time. And by that time already it was known that, when I finally went to Princeton to see him, it was known that John Paul was going to come. He wasn't here yet, but he was going to come. And I'll tell you this, because you don't know this. I went to Yang's office. Yang had been an old friend, and I had known him for many years. And I went to his office. He asked me a great deal about Stony Brook. He asked me how it was doing, what was happening. And then he asked me, does Stony Brook have an Einstein professor? And at that time I said, why don't you wait a moment? So then I remember I went to a telephone. I had pointed out to you the telephone cell in the Institute of Advanced Study, and I called up John Toll. And I told him, I said, Johnny, I said, I think if Stony Brook gets an Einstein chair, Yang will come. And then I remember Toll's answer precisely. He said, if you won't get Yang, I'll get a chair. So then I went back to Yang.
Yeah.
And he said, this maybe took only about half an hour. I went back and I said, yes, I think we're going to get an Einstein chair. And I said, would you consider this? And he said, well, it's offered to me. I was really confident. And he said, you always do it. That was all there was to that.
Okay.
So by that time, things were really evolving, and there was a great deal of excitement actually going on. I came, and you were, of course, were here, I had a feeling of a place in movement. Things were happening. We could get things done. Also, the fact that everybody knew everybody, I think, was enormously useful. I could go to you and say, Carl, I have a problem, and you might or might not be able to do something. But you know what I was about, and the same with Alex Tom, the same as many others. So it was really at that point, and that I also remember, I read in the master plan that there was a possibility for having institutes associated to the state system altogether, the Albany system. And there was a meeting, I remember that distinctly, there was Sam Gould, and there was Stanley Ross. And I think, I don't know whether he were there, but several people were there. We had a meeting. And Stanley Ross proposed an institute, for, at that time it was called a colonial institute, but that he can only use the name. So that became an institute for, I think, for Latin American studies. And I, at that time, proposed the institute should be a Latin American institute. And in fact, shortly thereafter, I actually wrote the institute for, I wrote the original program. Proposal, which was then okayed, and in fact, then Yang came as director of the institute. I became its executive officer, and that all started in 66. So I would think all of that was, I think, in terms of physics, and that's of course what I know about most. We did spectacularly well. Not only did we get Yang, but we also got Ben Lee, who was a nature person. Ben Lee, who was here, and then our first four postdocs were secured. They were Bardeen and Chris Craig and Yeto and Ratun Ye. Ye is a professor here now. Chris Craig is the director of the Theoretical Institute at Fermi Lab. Bardeen is one of the young hotshots in the Fermi Lab. And Yeto is the one of the associate director at Los Alamos. So the first years we did very well. So I would think in this first period, which was roughly from 64 to 68, I think, the great hopes and the great expectations were very heavily realized, I think. That was it. Well, what happened after then? Things really changed rather radically, and I would think it really started after I came back from a year in Europe. And that was related to the fact that the whole student situation all over the world, but also the country, became very difficult. There was the Vietnam War, which created an enormous trouble. There were very heavy drug problems. In fact, I went to Europe the same day the drug bust was there. I only saw it from Europe. I had made the Herald Tribune in Europe. Well, then when I came back, things were not better. And in fact, right after that, I will remember I came back there from the September of 69. There was something like a strike, and it was 3 days. There were 3 days when everything was stopped. And there were four lectures given at 3 days, which was organized by Sid Gelbum. That was, I forgot the students. I forgot one of them. But then I noticed the two keynote faculty members were Ed Pellegrino and myself. And as a consequence, a committee of 12, six faculty and six students were appointed. And that really changed my personal association very heavily. It changed it because I had been involved, of course, primarily in the teaching and in the research and in building that up. And from then, for really a long period, I would say easily from 69 till about 75 or 6, I was very heavily involved in almost all aspects of administration. I must have been on every committee that I was on. The Thermal Election Committee, which was from, I wrote the first draft of the Constitution. I was the first president of the University Senate. I was on the Thermal Election Committee. I don't really know what I was involved in, but I really cut very heavily into my research time and in my teaching time, although I really maintained it. So I would think that was sort of the second period from, I would say, about roughly 68 to about 75, 76. That was a period of difficulties. It was a problem. There was a great amount of building. There was a deep amount of unhappiness. At that time, that became evident, but it still is evident. There was a strong antagonism against sciences and against exact sciences by other parts of the campus, which found themselves to be mistreated. I looked into that once when I was chairman of the faculty, and I found to my great surprise that the highest average salary of full professors was not in physics, not in economics, but in Romance languages. Okay. And the reason for that was I then looked at, because Romance languages effectively every year got a new chairman, because they couldn't get along with the old chairman, and then you bring in the new chairman, the salary has to be higher than anybody else's, and that had gone on for 5-6 years. So I think the sciences were not really, in any objective sense that I can see, treated great deal better. The teaching loads were noticeably heavier. Some of them were very good, and there was also very uneven development. For example, mathematics when I came was not terribly good, but there were some, and in fact, it sort of had a languid existence for 7-8 years. And then John Tor, in what I think was a stroke of silk, appointed Jim Patton, who was a very go-getting person, and the mathematics department is where he's not today, excellent one. Almost since the day Jim Simons came. Then Jim left again, that was, I think, too bad. But nevertheless, the mathematics department has maintained a very high standard.
He's still around, is he?
Oh, he's still around, yes, I see him occasionally. You know. But he does all that, he can buy these universities, you know, if he wants to. So, I think the sort of thing, all those, I know John Tor had two ideas, which were not bad ideas. One was he did not think that A, it would be possible to get good faculty all the time, and B, he did not think he could get buildings all the time. So states would, there would be a finite amount of time when these things would be done. So he's faster. And I think that was perfectly sensible procedure. However, as a consequence, the amenities of life, the minimum way in which people lived, the auxiliary functions of the university, they were short, not so much short things, so there was no money left. I mean, if you get three outstanding people, which say he did in various areas, then there's no money left for first-rate registrar. And I think these troubles, in a way, are still with us, that the middle administration, the auxiliary services, the supporting services, they never really came up to what the rest of the university was. And the rest of it's not all so serious when you start out and things continue, then that creates a great deal of unhappiness and on the part of the students. So I would think the expectations were very great. I think in a way I think Stony Brook and the state should not be displeased. Stony Brook made from really nothing. I remember you drive them from planting fields to here every day, and I worried about the traffic which you had to go through. But so from a minor place, it became a major place, and it has now some of these difficulties, I think, these really remain. Now, if it was nobody's fault, it was the fact that the students and what student expectations they were radically altered. They were radically altered. Students became very politically active in the direction which is not so sympathetic to me. But I think with an academic life, or I think with a style of living, many of these things are not there, and they are very still not there.
It takes a long time to build up traditions.
Yeah, and that of course, you're quite right. It takes a long time to build traditions. That is also John's style. John wanted to build a building, and tradition too bad. But for students, it's very important that there's a place to go. For faculty, it's important. One of the things which I'm sure you remember from, we have talked about it literally now for 20 years, there's really no natural place for faculty to come, relax, and talk to each other, whether they complain about things. All we have now is the end of the bridge, which is, if not the worst, it's also not the best. The people in our minds, they mean well, but it's hard to have rock and roll and a lot more of students and a very uneven number of persons coming or going. That you cannot eat on the campus in the evening before a concert seems scandalous, and always seems scandalous, and nothing is done. That seems scandalous for 20 years.
Yeah.
And I think all of these are remnants, and it is about, because I should tell you something that's not related to me, but you might find it interesting. I was at the University, State University of Utah, in Logan, Utah, just now, which is a school of 12,000, not the best, not the worst. It's a very pretty place. First of all, the campus is spotless. And it's a pleasure to walk around and see flowers and green plants, and you don't see paper cups, and you don't see styrofoam, you don't see Coke bubbles. It's magnificent. You walk in the union, it's spotlessly clean. You are proud to take your friends there. But what most impressed me, there was something called the enrollment room. They have completely computerized the enrollment. So there was a big room, and in this room they had a list of all the courses which they teach in the fall. And then if you as a student want to enroll, you have a student card, like a credit card, a student number, and you say you want to take section 1 of course 200 in history of Western Europe, and then you punch it, and then it will say it's full, or it will say for this you need permission of the instructor, or you're in. And then you are in, and then you get a little piece of paper, that's it. So you can walk, students walk in there at any time, really up to day or night. And they have all these lines of enrollment are in a little bit of a line, because there are some popular courses they tend to overfill. But so you know, now if he had not done that, our library is the only one which is not computerized. We still sign in the old way with old slips. It is again an example that the supporting services have not really taken the attention. Well, I understood Jean-Paul's ideas, and I understood that he wanted to do that, and I think it was a legitimate choice. The addition to make the place more congenial, I think that has already not happened. And
is this sort of thing found anywhere else in the New York State system?
Yes, I would think it is not unheard of in the New York system. And if you, for example, the fact that there's a great deal of vandalism on the campus has been very much more pronounced in the neighborhood of New York than it would be in Ann Arbor or than it would be in Utah or someplace else. So we suffer from that, and that is in part that is the attitudes which are generated or produced by the large city syndrome, those are really there. If you go to Roosevelt University, which is in Chicago, you'll find a situation which, if anything, is worse. They have a union. If anything, worse than ours. Although on the other hand, if you go to Northwestern University, where the socioeconomic class is different, then you will get faculty pride. I think one of the things that worried, there are many decisions which have, I think, contributed to this. But I say this by education, because I think the graduate students in many areas here can and still get an extraordinarily good education. Their style of life is not the best, but they can get it. And in other areas, of course, the undergraduates, again, are somewhat mixed. I now teach them some. And we really come in two sharp groups. Those I don't have to teach, and those I can teach. Those I can teach, they have the general caliber of students has gone way down. And I must say that bothers me a lot. Yeah. It is a notice of the same when I came and when you still lived in Oyster Bay. The stories might be impossible, but they were good. You see, now that it's nearly impossible. And there are a few very good ones. If a student gets all A's from here as an undergraduate, he has it made. But there are many who are really, really quite good. And I think one should really watch for the future that somehow very good people are not really replaced by nearly possible people. We also, I think, have to be much stricter. This summer I had a workshop for high school teachers, and they were thrilled with the people. They talked to them about education. They were appalled by the dormitories in which they lived, and in fact, football, in whose name we are doing all of this. They gave him a terrible time, and he was thought about his research, and somebody noticed. And then he stopped us over. He stopped us laughing. He said, "You're also provost, what do you do?" And then he said, he talked about his functions as provost and the graduate and so on. And there was literally an explosion. He said, "How can you tolerate?" There's something that looks like the South Bronx with the windows smashed and with things boarded up and with filth all over the place. And we have got to do something about that, and I think the time is fast that we can really do these things. So in general, have I been... I also worked for the central. I never worked for the central office per se, but I was one of the. I don't know how it's called. One of the visiting scientists of the system. I was on call and I went to many places. I went to Onyanta, and I went to Oglesford and I went to Portland, and I think I must have gone to 10-12 of the major of the school there to what used to be Harper, but is now Binghamton. I know that really quite well. I've been in Buffalo, and I really, it was me in Albany quite often, in Albany. I organized for a while a joint physics colloquy of the four university centers. That is, I did that some 10, 12 years ago. These things always go for a while, and then they go away. then they really go away again. So I think, yes, it has become a well-known university. Well, I can of course name many individuals who did many things, like start out since you're sitting here with Newcall. You did a great, in fact, you held it together, but otherwise it would have collapsed. I think it really would not have been, I think so that's for that you need an enormous amount of credit. Then I should say something about Jean Paul, in fact, I'll let me say also something about Mr. Schmidt, who I did not know, because I was comrades, yeah. But I knew Jack Marbury very well. I think that is a good president, he's a little bit caught.
I don't know about what?
He's a little bit caught. No, caught. K-A-U-G-H-C. He's caught. Because he has got to maintain the research level. He has no choice because that's... He also also has to do something about the perception that living in Stony Brook is bad. And he says that there's nothing that he can do about it. He affronts the troubles, and he said, if I still am in a position to make recommendations, I would say I will really sharply cut the number of students who come from nearby. Because my office is on the 8th floor of the, and I, every Friday afternoon when I am working there, I look and the students just leave. Now, the students, you would understand, the students would go to Paris or Florence or San Francisco, I would say, all right, they go. But they go to Brentwood and Syosset. And there's no reason to do that. It means that the university, in a way, becomes a prolongation of the high schools. And that cannot be, and it also, for example, that this is the only university where the party night is Thursday night. Students go to parties on Thursday. They don't go to parties on Friday, because on Friday everybody is gone. Now that's scandalous, you see, because it means that Thursday, Friday, Saturday and Sunday are already gone. You see, it means that the establishment of an of atmosphere, as you say, is an ambiance, of a scientific ambiance. So I think Jack is trying very hard, and I think his ideas are right. He finds himself in a time of decreasing the resources and also decreasing our role, but also lowering. So I think that I would consider a very positive influence, although it is hard. I consider Bentley Glass a person who has done a considerable amount for the university. Bentley's style is different from Trondheim. He's a man of great eminence, but he's a man nevertheless of great integrity, and also I think of great, I would almost say cultural integrity.
Yeah.
He knows biology, he's a major biologist, he knows a lot of education, he's a person deeply interested in music, he goes to concerts, I go there and I see him there. So I think he is a very important person who I have seen there. I think the other functions are rather more difficult. I would think the positive ones certainly are John Paul, yourself, and as I said, Bentley. There was a whole group of people who did things. Stanley Ross tried. He was somewhat caught. Again, he did not. Sydney Gordon was mixed. I think Sydney had very good ideas. He had very good ideas. He always found himself in a somewhat ambiguous administrative situation, that he never felt he had quite enough power to do things. Alec Pons was a go-getter, but he was so identified with the policies of Toole, that whatever was good about him would be given to Toole, and whatever was bad about him was blamed on Alec. I thought, and I told him so, you can quote, he knows that very well, the most serious mistake he made is to try to become president here at the university. I thought that was extremely divisive. Mm-hmm. And I knew long ago that he would never make it. Because all the antagonism and all the resentment, A against sciences, B against the arbitrariness, all of that would be directed against him. And so I think Toole, So I think Alec had a very important role, but I think it was reasonably positive, but not altogether so. I think Yen created an image for the university, which was then a very important one, because it really showed that this was one of the major places for science. So I would think that was a very important place. Yen was not always wise. For example, he strongly supported Alec Pond in this abortive attempt for the presidency, and I told him there was going to be yet another revolt. That will not do. That the resentment really is too great. So I would think these are the main persons. I think Weisinger was a dean. Weisinger was a graduate dean. I would think he was a reasonably good dean, even a bit of a gadfly. He sort of, if he could say something clever, and it would give rise to an impossible policy, he would say something clever. Then he would be stuck with it. And I could give you numerous examples. I think Colin Greenough was an interesting person. Again, he put the place very much on the map. I liked him. Okay, I had nothing to fight with him, but I liked him a lot. Yeah. He was there because he had ideas, and he had initiatives, and he had strength. There was a man he brought in whose name was Knudsen, who I also thought was very, very good. In terms of the provost or the vice president was Alec, and then there was also Holman Mir, who I knew extremely well. He took two classes from me at Michigan. Okay. I think I know him well. Holman was in it. He was probably much too decent a person to be a good dean, because I thought he was a good administrator. He knew how to do it, and I think his heart was very much in the right place. I think he had many initiatives, and in a way, he should not have left when he did, because the initiatives were incomplete. and now they will, I think, go away. I think altogether, he was a great person.
Well, if I left the provost.
He left the provost, and he left the university also.
Oh, has he? I didn't know that.
Although he left the provost, and he is now chairman of the physics department at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes.
And did he know that?
Oh, yeah, he's gone. He got left. Has he come back? By the way, I knew Homer very well, and I often talk to him, and it is interesting that he was really happiest in the lab. He's from a business. And he looked different. When you saw Homer in the lab, working with his equipment, he looked, I barely recognized him. You see, because that was really what he wanted to do, that very hard one. And again, he was pressed from all sides, in all ways. But he was, and by the way, I make you a bet. I make you bet that in a year from now, Homer will be president of the University of Michigan.
Oh, really?
And it's only a bet. And I'll tell you why they said it. The president of Michigan, whose name was Mr. Shapiro, went to Princeton. And he's there now. They're looking for a president at Michigan.
That was what they had what?
They had Walton.
No, that was Michigan.
That was Michigan State. Walton was in Michigan.
Yes.
So I would think, this sort of gives you the general feeling. There may be other individuals. If you have more other questions, I will be very happy to.
Your impression of the way in which the central office, the chancellor and the subordinates there, regard Stony Brook, and the degree to which there is a conception of equity all around among the four university centers, as distinguished from the feeling that at least Stony Brook should be made the strongest of the four.
Yep. That impression is mixed, and let me tell you why. I was really in charge of the faculty between 4 and 6 years, so I had some. Very, very often, when I talked to the president, who at that time was John Toll, but also there was also Don Moran, and also, I mean, all kinds of limitations were imputed to the central administration. We cannot do this because. When I got to know especially Sam Gould, and there was another, who was the other person who was after Sam Gould? Ernie Boyer. And I got to know him quite well, because as chairman of the faculty, I went to quite a few meetings. I found that many of the limitations allegedly imposed by Albany were in point of fact not imposed by Albany, but were interpretations of Albany directives given locally. So I never had the impression that Albany was, the central administration was particularly prejudiced against, or for that matter, for the Stony Brook. Only very well, that I knew well, I could talk to him very easily, and I always found him reasonable and pleasant and sensible to listen to. So I think there are questions which are hard questions that are not just Stony Brook questions. They are questions if you had that manager system, that lot, should all the university centers do all things, or should all colleges or all centers do all things? Now that's no longer a purely scientific or educational question. That becomes a very heavy political question, and that therefore means it is very hard to discuss. I thought that to somehow, to somewhat specialize a little bit more, to say that if you have high-powered, particular kind of biochemistry, to do that in all four is probably not the wiser thing to do, but maybe you can pick two out of the four, and that can again be shuffled back and forth from one to another. It was not my impression that that was ever really thought about outside of the political realm, although I think it should, because it's clear the state is not that wealthy, they cannot really support everything or do everything. But I did not have a feeling of particular discrimination against or mistreatment. I did not really have that. There was perhaps a certain amount of indifference. If I see some indifference, I would actually attribute it more to the governor of the state than I did to the...
And the big change when Rockefeller...
Yeah. And that was really the big change. Rockefeller, and in fact I was at once, I represented, I forgot what it was. But when Rockefeller left, things were different. With Cuomo, I think the situation is almost extreme, because it's clear that his heart is totally in the private schools, and and at St. John's. As he says, every morning he looks at the St. John's ring and says, he's glad he's there. I'm happy that he feels that way for himself. It means that automatically the state system is going to be second in his appreciation and his attachment. So I know Wharton pretty well. I once gave a talk for all the university presidents, and John Toll was still there, Wharton was there, on the role of research. And Wharton was particularly agreeable to that, and even listened to me. So, as I said, I have not felt, certainly not very explicit. Again, that may vary from administration to administration, but it was not my personal feeling. That was very sad, it was not there at all. But out of it was, again, the personality of John Toll. John was such a drive on such a cushion. Says he will collapse without this, that meant he should give him half of what he wants. This becomes an automatic, this becomes a reaction. That might have been part of that. I have not talked at a great deal with Marburger about that. Let me say one of the things which was good, you know, when there was this assessment of physics departments all over the country.
Yeah.
The last known evaluation, I think Stony Brook came in either 11 or 12, I believe, in the country. And I thought, that means we were better than Michigan, better than Indiana, better than we were either right around Yale or right. So we really did exceedingly well, and that pleased me. By the way, I will make a prediction that the next way around, if we don't.